got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. There's a new study out this week suggesting that glyphosate might up your risk for a particular kind of cancer based on some experiments with lab mice. Now, the study's interesting because it contradicts the bulk of the research on glyphosate safety, which says that this chemical, which is the active ingredient in Bayer's Roundup herbicide, probably won't give you cancer. And so I want to get into this paper a little bit and figure out just how significant the results are. And to do that, I've got plant geneticist Kevin Folta with me. Kevin's a professor at the University of Florida and the host of the Talking Biotech podcast, which we also feature on the Genetic Literacy Project. So I read through this paper and I came up with some questions, and I'm just going to throw these at Kevin, and then he's going to add some more of his some scholarly insight that I couldn't provide. So without further ado, here we go. All right, Kevin, welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, really great, Cameron. Thanks for having me aboard again.
Yeah, my pleasure. I know we've talked before, but I think this is the first time officially on GLP's podcast, so I'm very excited. So this new study came out purporting to show that exposure to glyphosate might be a risk factor for a particular kind of cancer, and it was picked up on social media by certain activist groups and certain individuals. And I wanted to take a critical look at that study and just see how it stacks up. But before we get there, can you just give us an overview of what the researchers did and what they actually found?
Well, the paper was really touted as more definitive evidence linking glyphosate to cancers. And the general tone of this paper, it fits very much into, you can take all scientific reports and kind of fit them into different bins. And this one fits very nicely into the bin of when we beat a frog to death with a hammer, that frog exhibits some symptoms. And therefore, you know, hammers cause disease. It's when you provide so much of a insult to physiology that is genetic. So this was done in a strange genetic background we'll talk about in a minute, and then provide an overwhelmingly massive dose of chemistry. The organisms that have messed up genetics and messed up chemistry probably are going to show some problems. And that's exactly what kind of paper this is.
So tell us a little bit about the animals that they used and the study design itself, if you don't mind.
Well, the whole study itself was to test glyphosate, so the active ingredient in Roundup and other commercial herbicides, which has been a very controversial chemical, not necessarily in the scientific world, but certainly online and in the activist anti-farming communities, anti-genetic engineering communities. And what this group did, and this group has done a lot of work in this kind of area where they've looked at dioxin and other stuff and kind of go through the same battery of tests. And in this case, they applied the same battery of tests to glyphosate. And what they do is they start out with a mouse. And this mouse line is a standard black mouse line that is genetically altered. It's called a VK-MYC line. And VK-MYC mice have a genetic alteration that causes a what's termed a sporadic induction of MYC oncogene. So the MYC oncogene is a gene which is responsible for advancing different aspects of carcinogenic potential. And so they have these mice which are already in this mode. These mice are compromised. They're already taking a committed step toward development, more specifically, of lymphatic neoplasia, so issues of cancer in the lymphatic system. So that's the background of these particular mice.
Now, I have a few questions, so I'm just going to go through these and feel free to answer in as much detail as you want if you feel that I missed something. But one thing that struck me is right off the bat in the introduction to the paper, the authors seem to imply that there's more controversy than there is, and they talk about how certain regulatory agencies say that glyphosate probably doesn't cause cancer, but then IARC says it might cause cancer, and that seems incorrect to me, given what we know about IARCs. Would you comment on just the overall understanding that we have of glyphosate today?
Well, the overall understanding from the peer-reviewed literature and dozens of independent companies and dozens of independent regulatory agencies, which evaluate this on a rolling basis, is that there is no evidence of cancer, of carcinogenic potential when used as directed. And what this says is you can have occupational exposure, you can have the microscopic exposure that happens in food, and there's no potential. There's no reason to think that. And that the places where people do see issues are papers that either use massive doses and or use the whole compound, so the glyphosate plus the surfactants, the soaps that help it penetrate plant tissue, and you can kill cells in petri dishes with that, which is no surprise, or papers that show something but then never are repeated or expanded. So some reports which maybe came out in 2012 that people hold up as high evidence, but 7 years later, there's no additional investigation by that group or others. So most of this work goes to die and never be repeated. The IARC looked at all of the data from animal models, and they felt that they could say, well, this is a potential hazard. It is in the category of a probable carcinogen. Not probably carcinogenic, it is a probable carcinogen. It means that it may have the possibility of causing cancer under some conditions or possible circumstances. That's freely misinterpreted by everybody out there as widely as it can be, but that was the IARC's decision and one that's very controversial.
And just to underscore that point, we've done a couple articles on Genetic Literacy Project about little tiny cell culture studies that seem to suggest that glyphosate might actually kill cancer cells. And so just to show you the range of possibilities that you can get in a laboratory, that doesn't mean that, you know, you should start drinking glyphosate if, you know, you're worried about your risk of cancer, you know. So there's just so many possible conclusions you can get from this research.
And so many different papers have different models. They start with different questions. And what you have to really look for is reproducibility that happens from independent tests between laboratories. And that's the gold standard.
Now, the study, if I'm not mistaken, because it involved lab mice, the results are, you know, you can't really pull much from them, right? I think it was like per group in the experiments, it was only 10 mice. Is that right?
Well, they were relatively small numbers, but the reason that this was particularly useful is that this particular model, this VK-MYC line, is really good for understanding the progressions to multiple myelomas or multiple myeloma as a bloodborne cancer. And it mimics very carefully what happens in humans who have this state called MGUS, which is a state where the cells are already going through some changes and they've made some committed genetic steps in the blood, and that now something else might tip it over to malignant myeloma or multiple, you know, myeloma. And so this is where this mouse model is particularly useful. It's been really great because in the past, different research groups have used this model to examine how different therapies may be able to hinder that progression to full-blown multiple myeloma, as well as understand the progression genetically, you know, what could happen next. And it seems to mirror what happens in humans very carefully or very precisely. So that was a positive of the paper. It also was in a very good journal, which is, you know, reasonable impact BMC journal. So those were some of the things that were good things about the paper.
Okay, so at a foundational level, there's nothing wrong with the way they did the research. It just may be the conclusions that they're trying to draw or that other people might draw from the study. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, the problem is that they make conclusions that fail to consider the doses of the compounds that they used in the study. Maybe a good place to start is really, you know, let's let me put it this way. What they did was they used extremely high concentrations for a very long time and showed that under these conditions, you could identify problems in the mice, particularly the ones that had this genetically compromised state. So they were given loads and loads of herbicide for 72 weeks, which is like over 500 days. And normal mice and mutant mice, and then asked what is the difference with and without glyphosate in normal or in mutant mice. And then the rest of the paper describes all of the issues that did or did not occur as a function of the glyphosate or the mutation.
Now, there was one line in the paper I found very interesting, and comment on this, if you will. So they talk about the very large dose that they gave these mice, and they say, quote, "We are cognizant that an individual would unlikely consume such an excessive dose of glyphosate." And then they go on to explain why, nonetheless, we should reconsider the amount of exposure that people may have to this. So comment on that. So at least to my non-scientific eyes, that looks like a pretty big red flag. It's like, yeah, you know, we stuff these things full of this chemical that they're never going to be exposed to. But nonetheless, you know, here's our original point. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was really, really cheesy, because here you're using these massive doses. And just to give your listeners a perspective, they're giving on the order of 1,000 parts per million water. So the 1,000 parts per million glyphosate in water. So these animals are constantly drinking 1,000 parts per million of water day in and day out for 72 weeks. And to give you a sense of what that is between 1,000 and 100,000 times what the USDA is picking up on raw product. So the raw soybeans or the raw wheat in the USDA numbers that are very reliable. It is tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions of times higher than what people are claiming to detect on food and stuff, you know, through the diet. So these numbers are extremely high. And then in some of their work in here, they're what they call the acute studies. We can talk about this too. They're using 30,000 times what you would, or 30,000 ppm. So 30,000 parts per million. So we're normally, you know, the raw product has 0.1 or 1 or less. So this is a huge, huge dose for a very long time. And the funny part is all the mice live just fine except for the genetically compromised ones.
Yeah, and another thing to add to that, I looked this up last night from the EPA, and they said that the international estimated daily intake of glyphosate and major metabolites is estimated to be between 0 and 2% of the acceptable daily intake. And so not only does the EPA set a threshold that's inflated just to be safe, I mean, we're getting just fractions of that anyway. And then this study is feeding these mice way above what the EPA says is safe. So just to put that in perspective for people, I think that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Oh, can I throw in this too? I did a little bit of the math on this, but essentially what they're feeding these animals day in and day out is what you would consume if there was the highest levels that have been recorded on 31 square meters of crops. So if from raw material, like the raw spray with all of it being present. So this is a massive dose of, this is what is used on 31 square meters of field. And that's what they're constantly eating all day, every day. And so, you know, the equivalent for a human at whatever the numbers they gave. So it's just a massive dose that doesn't reflect any kind of realistic dose. Yet the authors make this jump that in the title say glyphosate induces benign monoclonal gammopathy, you know, which is that first committed step to myeloma. And within the entire document, even here in the abstract, say, you know, these data support glyphosate as an environmental risk factor. Okay, a risk factor, which we know that risk is a question of exposure, not just the hazard, and that for multiple myeloma and potentially non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which there's no data to support that, and implicate a mechanism underlying B cell specificity, which they did implicate a mechanism that's important, of glyphosate-induced carcinogenesis observed epidemiologically. So what they're saying is based on these epidemiological studies that have been observed, which are pretty, you know, suggestive but not, you know, there's no really strong definitive data that's reproducible. They kind of make this connection. And they're really getting out the thumbtacks and the yarn here in trying to make associations that are very weakly supported, but saying so with great conviction.
Yeah, and two other things from the paper, and we can wrap up pretty quick, but I thought these were interesting, and maybe I'm making something of these when they're not. But in the conclusion of the paper, or the discussion section, they say two other rat studies reported increased incidences of cancer. However, the animals receiving the highest doses developed these tumors at a lower incidence than those receiving the intermediate doses. So to me, that sounds like the animals getting the highest dose weren't getting sicker. It was the ones getting less. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's a failure of dose response, and that usually is a hallmark of something not being correct or some other type of overlay. That usually when you're seeing something like, if you're saying X causes Y, more X should cause more Y, and that should obey a very predictable pattern that eventually maybe it'll level off, but you should be able to increase the dose and increase the response. And that's something that fails in a lot of these experiments, which means that you just have to take them with a grain of salt.
Right. Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's kind of like saying if you smoke a half a pack of cigarettes a day, you're more likely to develop lung cancer than if you smoke two packs a day, which obviously nobody believes that. But I think that's what this is saying in you know, the context of glyphosate, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Okay.
It's not showing dose response kinetics, you know, as we'd say in science.
Okay. I had Jeffrey Cabot on the podcast a couple months ago, and I know you're familiar with his work, but he basically said, and he said this in articles too, is that he says that this chemical glyphosate has been studied so well and so thoroughly that we're running out of studies that we can do on it. And he said, you know, maybe if someone came up with some truly unique study design, you know, that might make sense, but we're running out of things to investigate this chemical for. Would you agree with that assessment, or are we just kind of spinning our wheels here at this point?
No, I think that, you know, that when you start seeing very low associations, statistically significant data, so that means just like things that can't be attributed necessarily to chance, you see these little bitty blips of barely significant data. And sometimes when you see that over and over again, which we don't with glyphosate, but if you do see it here and there, could there be some other confounding variable like genetics? That if you looked at the people who did get non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and they were, or multiple myeloma, and they were glyphosate users, did they share some sort of a genetic anomaly which changed the way it turned over in the body? Or, you know, is there some sort of predisposition like these mice have that those people would have? And you can check for that genetically. And so those are the kinds of studies that I would be designing, is looking at the people who are making the claims of being ill and looking for commonalities that may actually make them genetically predisposed. And then we could provide better guidance as to the use of the product. But, you know, that would be, right now it's so well studied, I can't think of any other easy studies to do.
Yeah, and one other question, I just thought of this, but a big epidemiological study like the agricultural health study, that the final iteration that came out in December 2017, wouldn't they have picked up on something like this? Like, if this is a real effect that they're observing, it just seems like somebody else would have found it already, you know, probably in humans too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I don't think that there's a question about that. The reports that make some association are sporadic at best. We know that farmers have higher incidences of all kinds of different cancers, and well, in some cancers, that's been shown in different reports here and there, that farmers tend to have different levels of these things, but they're associated with so many different compounds and so many different things, from, you know, diesel exhaust to, you know, long nights working to, you know, so many other environmental and work-related, occupational-related variables. And to try to single out this one, when you really do that statistically, it just doesn't hold up consistently.
All right, so maybe we can leave it here and just say, don't drink 1,000 milligrams of glyphosate.
Well, you know, if we could, I mean, I'd love to touch a little bit more on a couple things of the paper, just so your audience can...
Yeah, as long as you want to go.
Yeah, let's go into a couple more goodies in the paper, because some of the stuff that is in the paper that I noticed that just drove me crazy, if I was a reviewer, You know, when you start out the thing by saying glyphosate is the most popular and profitable agrochemical, you can kind of see that there's something odd here. You're now starting to set up, you know, popular and profitable isn't scientific language. If we're talking about a chemical here, and as you go down through this, they miscite all of their references. They say it's been detected in more than 50% of surface waters in the USA. The USGS found it in 39%, which, you know, it's still pretty high, but they detected it in 39%. And if you think about how widely this stuff is used in agriculture, that's not surprising. They checked in 38 states and 1,300 water bodies, 3,700 samples. And they detected it at levels mostly of, with a median concentration below 0.02 micrograms per liter, so parts per trillion, 20 parts per trillion. And USGS, so this is 20 seconds since the birth of Christ, just to give you a scale. They claim to make this detection, and USGS, outstanding. They got the level of detection all the way down to 20 parts per trillion. What this group says is, well, it's a median concentration of about 20 parts per trillion. What USGS reported was it was a median below 20 parts per trillion because they couldn't detect it any lower with fidelity. And so in other words, you know, the people who did this paper didn't get those numbers exactly right. And they make a lot of other claims, like how it's found in soil and air. The air thing came from Majeski 2014, where they measured 26 nanograms per square meter. So like 20 seconds since the birth of dinosaurs, in 3 meters from a cotton field where it was applied. And with that data, people are saying, oh, it's in all the air we breathe. No, this is right next to a field where it was applied. So there's a lot of disingenuous stuff here that is in there. And some of the data they report comes from Mills et al., which was the work with Fagan from the guy who has been a Maharishi cult anti-GMO guy for years, runs an analytical chemistry lab in Fairfield, Iowa. And he and this guy Mills and others have made claims about glyphosate in urine. They're conflicted in lots of ways and got called out on COIs in the following version of JAMA after this paper was published. A lot going on there too. But in general, the whole thing with this, as I read this, the other beautiful thing about this introduction is they state things that aren't true. They said this. They said, they talked about the IARC, and then they said these three case control studies performed in Iowa, France, and Canada suggest that glyphosate exposure increases multiple myeloma risk. The first study they said from Iowa was from 1993 and said very clearly, I wrote this down right out of the study. Study found little evidence to suggest associations between multiple myeloma farmers and pesticides. The second study, I don't remember what that one said, but the third one said it's not significant. The associations are suggestive but not significant. So here they cite three sources, at least two of which says the opposite of what they're claiming it says.
Yeah, it's almost like they have to acknowledge the literature or people are going to blast them, but they don't want to talk about it. So they're like, yeah, and this not statistically significant. But anyway, so there's glyphosate everywhere. So.
Well, what it is they set up an argument saying that there are reports from the IARC, and then there's these ones that show associations and these others that don't. And so we have to look at it. But the premise is wrong because the articles they cite don't say what they're saying they say. And I really had I went through quite a bit of time going through all this, and overall, I mean, it's not absolutely awful work. They did nice work to do it, but it was a flawed idea. You feed a genetically compromised mouse a mountain of a chemical, and 500 days later find out it's not well. the normal mice, you could feed them glyphosate at 1,000 ppm a day, 1,000 ppm in their drinking water. And over a year, they showed some symptoms, you know, some alterations of blood markers, like lower red blood cell counts, a few other things like that. But in general, they lived just fine. They didn't have decreased lifespan. They didn't have very extreme changes in body composition or anything, and, you know, tissue samples that they looked at. They'd see little things here and there, but in terms of spleen and bone and that kind of thing. But in general, it wasn't. It may be indicative of animals that have been drinking a chemical that's not intended to be drank for a year and a half.
Right. So as we said, don't drink 1,000 milligrams of glyphosate and you'll probably be okay. What has the response been to this paper? I know when we were talking, I said I saw certain individuals that we can talk about if you want to, but people that are inclined to believe any research that's hostile to biotechnology were either retweeting this paper or asking questions about how significant it was. And so what's the reaction been from the popular press and from average people, would you say?
I think it's been snooze. I mean, I haven't seen much from the popular press on this, and I haven't seen anybody really talking about it other than a few of our favorite folks who say, aha, more smoking gun evidence. And what was really kind of funny about that is that the folks who are pointing this out as very definitive evidence of the problematic nature of the chemical really didn't realize the paper said this stuff's probably pretty safe. That you can drink. I mean, if there's one interpretation you can take home from this thing, is don't drink, as you were saying, 1,000 ppm glyphosate, or the amount of that's being sprayed on a 31 meter square meter area of farmland over every day. And if you have genetic predisposition towards multiple myeloma, definitely don't drink that much glyphosate.
Oh, well, I'm glad we put those qualifications in there, but I'm also kind of sad that we had to.
But it does, it really reinforces the fact that, you know, there's a lot of science out there that maybe isn't the worst science in the world in terms of, you know, doing the experiment and saying, you know, if I hit this frog with a hammer 30 times, it doesn't jump anymore. Therefore, hammers cause frog cancer. You know, they're making these cognitive leaps by taking something that is compromised genetically, hitting it with mountains of chemistry, and then seeing weird stuff happen. And what you could be seeing in a study like this, after 500 days of giving those high doses, if there is some minor effect that's happening chronically to the liver, you now put the entire system in a sense of dystrophy, where now the spleen is operating differently. Maybe the blood is going to look a little different. That makes total sense to me. I would expect that you would see some sort of change after that kind of chronic high dose. So these are really set up to kind of, they bother me because it doesn't seem like honest application up to the question. But when you read their conclusions throughout, at the end of every single section of the paper, it says, you know, these results show that glyphosate contributes to breakdown of this, this, and this. Or, you know, like I'll read one verbatim just to give you a sense of how definitive they make it sound. They say, given the role of this gene in these results from mice with chronic and acute glyphosate treatment support a mutational mechanism in the etiology of this. You know, they don't say that it takes massive doses. And they connect what is an on-farm use, or the assumption of an on-farm use, or food-related exposure to the progression of disease. And you can't make that leap.
If you're the editor of this journal, you're one of the peer reviewers on this paper, I mean, what do you say? Do you say, hey, you need to fix X, Y, and Z, and then maybe we'll publish it? Or do you just not publish it?
No, if I'm a reviewer, I tell them to correct their background and their citations. I remove the citations of Seralini's work, which has already been shown to be highly questionable. I ask them to tone down their conclusions based upon the high doses given, and that they need to recognize and say, you know, we know that these are doses that would never be encountered in food or occupational, but we use them to begin to find a beginning starting point of things to look for in tissue and gene expression in order to understand how this could possibly contribute. You know, if they really watered it down, I would still be able to accept it because technically it seems pretty solid. The problem is they answered the question using a sledgehammer rather than a scalpel. And sometimes when you feed something a mountain of herbicide, maybe funny stuff's going to happen after a year and a half.
All right. Well, we'll wrap it up there. Kevin, why don't you give people a plug? I know you've been doing your podcast forever, and I listen to it every week, and I really get a lot out of it. So tell us about that, and then tell us about whatever else you're doing right now.
Well, that's really cool. Yeah, we're at the Talking Biotech Podcast, which is talkingbiotechpodcast.com. On Twitter, I'm at Kevin Folta. And, of course, any of the research work we do is mostly in plant genomics and in photobiology that you can find kind of anywhere online. And reach out if you ever have any questions. The other important take-home point on this is that even though folks on social media, like, you know, whether you're a veterinarian in California or I don't know where that guy is who always hassles me, but they say they said flat out that a plant biologist can't possibly begin to interpret cancer research. And it's important just for everyone to keep in mind that if you study the science, you understand how this works, you understand the scientific method and statistics, that it is possible for us to get something important out of these papers and help apply it to understanding the bigger questions around agriculture. So dig in and really try to learn them and reach out if you have any questions.
Yeah, and Kevin will actually talk to you. That's one thing I learned early on, is if you tweet at him, he'll respond. So if you want to learn some science, then hit up Kevin Fultz on Twitter. All right, Kevin, hey, thank you so much, and we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, you bet. Anytime, you know, just let me know. I'm always around.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us. We will see you next time. As always, I want to remind you to check us out on iTunes and Spotify, and check out the podcast at geneticliteracyproject.org.